Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition and special Thanksgiving edition. I hope everybody, all of our U.S. listeners, had a very happy Thanksgiving. We are going to be talking a lot on this weekend show about the correction that we saw this week in the precious metals, that unfortunately, pretty large correction here that has taken a lot of the positive momentum out of the last couple months, or at least month and a half. And now with gold, where it's trading as we're recording this midway through the day on Wednesday, right before Thanksgiving, it's given up all of its gains for this month. So November looks like it could be a negative month for gold. Pretty shocking when you consider just how much positivity we had just a week ago in the sector. We are kicking off the show with Adrian Day, president of Adrian Day Asset Management, also manages the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund. Adrian, let's start with this pullback in the precious metals. Gold has dropped over $100 from a recent high. A lot of the blame this week is being placed on the fact that Jerome Powell was reappointed to the chairmanship of the Fed, but to me, that seems like a bit of an excuse because that was, for the most part, expected. What's your takeaway, Adrian, from this pullback in precious metals this week?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. Yeah, gold. I think you're right. The Powell reappointment is sort of being talked about as a trigger or the excuse. But as you indicated, that was well telegraphed ahead of time. It would have been more of a surprise had he not been reappointed. A couple of things, I think. We were chatting before the show, and you pointed out that gold had had a very, very sharp run-up in the first 2 weeks of November. And so anytime you get that sharp run-up in any market, frankly, in any market, but that asset becomes vulnerable to a sell-off. And so it just took a trigger. And that's the way I would look at it. I'd also point out that, you know, we had another one of those 8 o'clock sell-offs, 8 o'clock East Coast time, when, I don't know, 3 days out of four, the gold market seems to sell off at 8 o'clock in the morning. And we had a very sharp sell-off Monday morning. And that, of course, was before the Powell announcement. So the announcement came into an already bearish environment for gold. I mean, it dropped over $30 a day, you know, 2 minutes after 8 o'clock. And so the market was already nervous when the announcement came. And I think that's the background that I would put to it. I mean, Powell is hardly a hawk. Powell could hardly have been more dovish over the last 18 months. So there's nothing in Powell's reappointment that should make the gold market nervous.
Well, Adrian, that's one of the questions I had, is that most people were already comfortable with Powell for the last 3.5 years. And when gold actually started running at the very end of the third quarter, when it closed, it kind of dipped down to some dangerous levels, and so did the miners. And then they reversed course into September. It was already on a good truck higher for all of October and November with Powell in place. And the reason that it spiked up even higher over the last couple of weeks was the Fed starting tapering and the hot CPI reading at 6.2% inflation that came in on the U.S. Consumer Price Index. All of those fundamentals are still there. So it seemed very strange for the metals to sell off so hard that in the middle of the morning, like you mentioned, all in a few minutes, just because Powell stayed. He was already a known entity. So all of the inflation is still there. All of the Fed policy decisions they've got to make over the next 6 months about ending tapering and starting rate hiking are still there. Do you think there's anything that's fundamentally changed over the last week that explains such a sharp decline?
We have, of course, had a few more Fed officials, whether they're members of the Open Market Committee or the regional presidents, or even including some former presidents who are a little more outspoken. But we've had several Fed officials increasingly in the last few weeks, sort of indicate that we should maybe taper more rapidly, Ballard, of course, was one who said that tapering might come quicker and then we can start to raise rates sooner. And so we've had a little more of that, and the consensus among various Fed officials for raising rates seems to be to raise a little bit more and a little bit sooner. But these are there, as I say, they include people who are not on the FOMC, and they include who don't actually set the rates, and they include people, they include former officials who may be experienced but don't have a vote on the issue. So I think that set a more bearish tone. But the reality is, as always with gold, when people talk about, when the Fed talks about tightening, the Fed gets nervous. I mean, the gold market gets nervous. But we need to look at what they actually do. And if we look at the next couple of years, the odds of the Federal Reserve suddenly becoming more hawkish, tightening more and sooner, I think is so remote that we shouldn't be concerned about it. I mean, again, if you look at what Powell's done since he's been nominated, he could not have been more dovish. They've made it clear that they're going to finish tapering before they start to raise interest rates. And no one, not even Bullard and others, have contradicted that. They've just said, let's get tapering done more rapidly so that we can raise rates sooner. But they've made it clear they want to finish tapering before they start raising rates. And again, as we talked last time, what is tapering? You know, people are so scared of it. The Fed loves to use these uncommon words, which I think, you know, sort of scare people, frighten people, or just confuse people. But I mean, all they're doing is reducing the rate at which they're increasing the money supply. They're not cutting anything. The Fed's balance sheet, under their existing plans, the Fed's balance sheet is going to be higher when they finish tapering than it is today, and interest rates, Fed funds rates, are still going to be essentially zero when they finish tapering. So that's not exactly hawkish.
I agree with you, Adrian. It is not hawkish, but I think the problem being for some of the gold bugs out there saying, look, I've heard this narrative that gold should be going higher when inflation is up, when interest rates are low, that whole negative real yield environment, which we have. And inflation is at 30 plus year highs. Gold isn't at its highs, though. So that's the big disconnect that I think some investors, too, are just saying, I'm done with this market because every other market seems to be performing better than the gold market, whether it's supposed to be an inflation hedge or not. So what do you take away from this environment where the data does seem to be lining up for higher gold prices, but gold can't break out?
No, you're absolutely correct, of course. And you hit on the two things. One thing is other markets are doing well. Maybe the U.S. stock market is not doing quite as well in the last week as it has done, but other markets are still doing well. And when other markets generally are doing well, people don't see the need for gold. I think that will change. The second thing I would say is, as we talked, Fed talk makes gold bearish. Fed action tends to make gold bullish because it's always too little too late. And we saw this remarkably clearly on, what, November the 3rd or something, when gold bottomed the very same day that Powell announced the timetable. Yes, we're definitely going to start tapering. And so you had a perfect example of when the Fed starts, gold moves up. And I think it's that talk in the last week, 10 days, that's maybe made the market a little bit nervous. Well, gee, are they going to tighten a little quicker than we thought they would? The only other thing I'd say, honestly, if you look at the gold market over 50 years, there have been several bull phases with sharp mid-cycle corrections. When you think of 1975, 76, it was what? Gold fell about 80%, not 80%, I'm sorry. Gold fell about 40% over the course of 15 months. And at that time, people were saying, it's all over. It was just a recovery from the fake $35 an ounce price. Yes, gold is a barbarous relic. And one by one, gold believers started dropping off. That was 15 months. And I think you get the same kind of nervousness, understandable nervousness, but you get the same kind of nervousness every time, you know, gold has these mid-cycle corrections. So, you know, one of two things will happen, in my view, over the next 6 months. It'll become increasingly, the market will become increasingly aware that the Fed is not going to tighten dramatically. But that won't be an event, right? That'll be an increasing awareness. I mean, I don't think the Fed's going to suddenly say halfway through, well, we'll stop tapering. You know, we're going to reverse course. That might happen in a year or two, but it's not going to happen in the next few months. And, you know, the second thing that might happen is the stock market sells off and or Bitcoin collapses and people feel they need to turn back to gold. I should correct what I just said. I mean, I think there is a very high possibility over the next, let's say, before the end of next year, that the Fed starts to slow down on either its tapering or postpone its planned interest rate hikes or in some way introduce another QE because of a slowdown in the economy.
Yeah, Adrian, we'll have to see how it all plays out. But the Fed has not got a track record of being consistent in their plans. Sometimes they flip-flop, sometimes they change directions. And you brought up the 1970s there. It should also be pointed out that gold lagged a lot of the other sectors. And I'm sure that people in that 75, 76 region you were talking about were saying the same things we're saying now. I guess gold's not keeping up. Everything else is racing higher. And then at the very end of the decade, gold shot up past everything. And I would submit that while we are seeing 30-year highs in inflation, gold already had sniffed that out. Let's not forget last year, gold made all-time highs, 50-year highs. So it's not just that it's absolutely the highest in 30 years. It was the highest in 50 years. It was the highest ever last year. So to have a 16-month correction after that and digest a gain of that kind of a run from 2019 and 2020 was sniffing out that all this money supply and all this government stimulus was going to create inflation. So isn't that possibly what could happen?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, last time we were on the show, I said one of the reasons was we were still in a consolidation from that big run-up at the beginning of 2020. No, I think in 3, 4, 5 years, when we look back in retrospect, we'll be saying exactly what you just said.
Well, I think a lot of the gold investors are sure hoping that that is correct, Adrian, because, yeah, unfortunately, there are just other sectors that have done better than the precious metals, and we've even seen the stocks lagging. Let's quickly get your comments on the stocks, because look, these stocks continue to lag. Seems like it's a bigger picture of gold just being unloved and that trade being kind of secondary to a lot of investors, maybe not even secondary, further back in their minds. What are you looking at in terms of the stocks? Are you being more aggressive with managing your portfolio? Are you waiting to see where a bottom might be? Take us through a little bit of your thoughts on the underlying metals, precious metal stocks, please.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. One is, let's not forget, when gold does turn, the stocks turn very dramatically. I just happened to pull up Barrick. It's not the best example, but, you know, that was up from $18.37 to $21 in 2 weeks. That's not too bad. And others, of course, did a lot better. So when gold turns, these will move dramatically. They continue to be extremely undervalued on any fundamental basis. The gold stocks, the senior gold stocks, like the XAU, for example, continue to trade very close to their long-term, if not all, on some metrics, all-term lows in terms of valuation, which just doesn't make sense when you look at where the market is. One main reason, of course, as you say, unloved. I mean, generalists are just not interested in gold stocks. And you know, the gold bug community or the gold investing community, you know, they can buy all they want, but they're just not enough of us to really get the market going. You need ordinary, everyday, you know, generalist investors, whether it's mutual funds, institutions, pension funds, retail investors, and so on. And they are simply not interested at the moment. And, you know, it's because of the things we've mentioned. You know, gold keeps going up and coming back again. So those who did step their toes into the water have got disenchanted. And other things are doing well. We know that will change. We know that will change. And it doesn't take a lot of buying from generalist investors. You know, if mutual funds put 0.5% or 1% of their portfolio into gold stocks, the stocks would go up 50 to 100%, because the market is so small. So what am I doing? You know, I continue to focus on the larger companies because they are typically the first to move in a gold move and the more certain to move, as we've discussed before. So if you buy Barrick and Agnico and Franco and Osisko, gold goes to 2,000. You can be as sure as you can be of almost anything that those will be up and will be up significantly. And more, of course, other stocks, Kinross and so on. I'm still waiting to see if we get, I mean, I think this pullback in gold will produce some very good tax loss selling next month. So given the gains that people have in many, many markets, from real estate to broad stock market to Tesla to Bitcoin to everything else, and even to oil stocks, gold is about the only sector where people have losses, the only broad sector. So I think we're going to see some tax loss selling next month. And it's interesting. I had some people call me about tax loss selling. I always remind people in September. I say, let's do it early before everybody else does it. I had a few people in September, early October, who wanted tax losses. November, I had no one. You know what? If you hadn't taken those losses, maybe I don't need them anymore. You know, but the market was going up. So people didn't want to sell stocks when the market was going up. Now, the last 2 days, I've had another flood of people asking for tax loss selling because the market's down. So I think we could see a lot of tax loss selling, and we shouldn't underestimate that. You look at some of these smaller stocks. I was going to pick on one, but I won't name it, but let's just look at the volume. You look at some of these smaller stocks where people have, you know, 50% losses this year. They didn't have losses last year, so they didn't take the tax losses last year. 50% losses this year, and the volume. I just pulled up a well-known name. I won't name it, but it's done 800 shares today. So if one person decides to sell his $10,000 position, the stock goes down. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that. And we're going to see that because with tax loss selling, it's really interesting. When people want to sell something for a profit, they can be very picky on the price. No, put it in a 51.21. I don't want to sell it at 51.20. 51.21, that's my price. If people are selling because they're fed up with a company, or if people are selling because of a tax loss, they don't put a limit in. Just, I want a tax loss, sell it. So I think we're going to see some pretty dramatic prices next month among the juniors.
Adrian, we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you for taking the first two segments of this show and outlining your thoughts on the precious metals. Wish it was a bit more of a positive report heading into the end of this year. But remember, a lot of those tax loss selling times are typically at least good short-term investment opportunities. And who knows, if you believe that a bottom could be in for gold and that it's going to go higher next year, then tax loss selling, especially if you have cash on the sidelines, can be a great time to be buying. Adrian, as always,
absolutely
great chatting with you. Thank you again for taking time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
And you. Thank you so much.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments where we really did just focus on the precious metals market as we chatted with Adrian Day. We're going to shift our focus a little bit now to the broad U.S. equity markets as we are chatting with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago, also editor over at the Lyons Share Pro website. One thing I should note, too, is that Dana is doing a Black Friday sale, 35% off the Lyons Share Pro website. This is the biggest sale that Dana runs every year. And Dana, I have to say, throughout this year, and we have you on about every 2 weeks, you've been spot on when it comes to the U.S. equity markets and other sectors. We've looked at international markets. We've also talked about the metals markets. You don't care what you invest in. You just go to your models and make sure your models are pointing to a more bullish outlook. And yeah, as I said, boy, oh boy, you have been pretty much spot on this year. So kudos to you. But hey, let's follow up on this and start off with the U.S. equity markets. This week, shortened trading week, the market's relatively flat. We are recording this late in the day on Wednesday, right before Thanksgiving. The argument being for some of these U.S. equity markets is that if they're not up every week, people start to say, oh, the momentum is waning. Maybe a top is in place. Last time we had you on, just a couple weeks ago, though, you did outline a more bullish outlook for these markets. What are you seeing now, Dana?
Yeah, that's right. First off, thank you for the kind words. Much appreciated. As far as the market, yeah, we have been lining up for a after the much talked about two-way market, the sideways market that we're in since basically late spring. We had been lining up for a nice intermediate term low and more of a sustained breakout and up move. We still think we're lining up for that. There have been some flies in the ointment, despite most of our quantitative measures being in a bullish stance, as there always are. There's always something to worry about, which, as I mentioned before, that makes the post-election rally of last year so unusual. There was nothing to complain about. Everything was pretty much aligned to the bullish side, at least after the rally got going. It caught a lot of people off guard who were not expecting it going into the election. They were expecting chaos. But once that got going, everything was clicking on all cylinders. Now, last time we talked, we did outline a bullish scenario, which I think is still shaping up there. That, as I mentioned, there are always some things to worry about. One thing at the time I mentioned a couple weeks ago was high yield, the action in the high yield market was not very constructive, and it remains unconstructive, hitting new lows for the last several months. So that was one area that has been, that was a bit of a red flag that we weren't necessarily ready to blast off yet. Another, for us, the most important fly in the ointment was the fact that our quantitative model, well, it looked like it was about to turn bullish. And again, it's an intermediate term model. So basically, the signals are like from 2 to 8 months in general. And that was mostly bullish, except for one key breadth indicator, which refused to budge. And indeed, we've seen markets pull back over the last few weeks, despite that much, that transparent, obvious breakout in the small cap averages a couple weeks ago. We pulled back over the last few weeks. And just a good reminder to me that the quantitative, our objective quantitative models are always smarter than we are as we see things. We're not immune to human natural feelings as investors. And that's why we designed the models to be, you know, quantitative and objective. And they were giving us a heads up that that not all the breath signals were lined up for, you know, escape velocity. We're not ready for that sustained breakout and new up leg in the bull market just yet. And we've seen breath deteriorate since then. We're seeing proliferation in new lows, which is a concern, a genuine concern. One caveat is that there are about 60% more issues traded now than there were about 16 months ago. So the number of new lows is not as concerning as the percentage of new lows, but it's still elevated. So still something to concern about. Like I said, there's always something to worry about. And right now we do have a couple things, but overall, we are still aligning ourselves for that next bull leg up. And we've been buying some more on this recent dip and covering some of our hedges as well.
Well, Dana, when you see the market breadth being not as healthy, and some have said it's, the markets are racing to new highs in the indexes, but on a deteriorating foundation, and when you see the number of new lows rising and the percentage of new lows rising, but at the same time, you mentioned that run in the small cap stocks that started, and it seemed like a pretty obvious setup. It had based for a long time. Could there be a rotation out of some of these larger index names and some of these high flying mania stocks into the smaller caps? And would that address all of those issues, the market breadth? Would it take some of those struggling small caps and boost them up? Could that be a trend that we see develop?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. One thing that we have been seeing, you know, almost all year is this constant rotation where you've had in favor areas of the market for a while is technology and healthcare. Then those went out of favor. You had some new leaders take hold, financials and materials, consumer discretionary, what have you. And you've had this ping-ponging rotational effect going on. And certainly that could be one thing we're seeing now. We certainly saw those large cap averages, the NASDAQ, the large cap growth indices, several of those indices running into even earlier this week, even almost now, running into some of those at least short-term Fibonacci extension lines from the recent correction, which just an indication of short-term extended status, even as, you know, the breadth was indicative of more, maybe a more broader and smaller cap pullback in those areas of the market. Now, as you mentioned, that obvious and well-publicized breakout in the small caps and broad market a couple of weeks ago, which I would say is not, despite the pullback of late, that has not been nullified. I think all we're seeing now is a unsurprising pullback in an immediate failure in that breakout to pull back and test that breakout level, or at least test the launch level in those broader and smaller and mid-cap averages. So not unusual to see those quote-unquote breakouts fail, at least in the short term, and come back and test those breakout levels or launch levels. And we would argue probably gearing up for at least a successful test, successful hold, and then maybe a more sustainable launch going forward, which presumably would be associated with or accompanied by, you know, improving breadth statistics and manifested better internal statistics and maybe rebuild that foundation underneath the market. So we would not be surprised certainly to see that. And in general, despite the more recent breadth concerns, and on a longer term scale, still the breadth picture is pretty good. It's like looking at the a bigger picture of the indices. You know, overall, we're still getting higher highs, higher lows. So is short term, yeah, it has been a concern. In the grand scheme of things, nothing has changed our mind that, we're still in an intermediate term bull market here.
Dana, how do you see investor psychology and where investors are interested right now? Because it does still seem like, look, money is staying within these markets. And I think it's hard to say that investors are scared, because it seems like, look, everything is going fairly well. I realize the breadth is not up there for these markets, but when I look around, places are busy and investors are still taking, I think, very much a risk on attitude. What's your assessment of what's going through the head of investors right now?
Yeah, that's a good point. I would say, you know, on a short-term basis, maybe the most helpful analytical tool is indeed investor sentiment. You know, that was probably one thing that contributed to, you know, the rug being pulled out of that, that obvious small cap breakout a couple of weeks ago, is the fact that, you know, despite the pullback in September, people jumped back on that rally really quickly. in October, and we saw the breakout. Everyone was talking about the breakout, which whenever it's talking about it, you know what generally happens is it, like I mentioned before, it typically fails, at least temporarily. So I think investor sentiment did get a little bit too complacent again, which again contributed to the recent pullback or the ongoing pullback that we're seeing right now. Just to reset investor sentiment a little bit, we are seeing finally a bit of an uptick in cautiousness and investor fear. We're still not at bottoming levels or capitulatory levels or anything like that, but at least we're we pulled back from, you know, those ultra complacent, ultra bullish investor sentiment levels that we saw a couple weeks ago. So and this kind of back and forth market does tend to contribute to more subdued investor sentiment. When people don't genuinely believe in breakouts, then they are more apt to be successful. So maybe the next breakout attempt that we get, maybe it won't be as highly publicized, maybe it won't be as embraced by the investment community. And if that's the case, it's probably more, more likely to succeed.
Well, Dana, just real quick on the idea of sentiment. We hear that tossed around a lot, that term, investor sentiment. How do you actually measure it? Are you looking at volatility indexes? Are you looking at daily sentiment index readings? Are you looking at true strength indicators? How do you quantify sentiment when you're using your quant methods?
Yeah, some of the favorite indicators that we use, some of the ones that you mentioned, some of the volatility market, some of the volatility measures, especially as it applies to the term structure of volatility market. So where are they buying the fear? Is it the front month when it gets jacked up in the front versus the longer dated volatility measures? Then that's a better sign of fear. So we like to watch the term structure in the volatility market, like to watch the equity options market, which has been, pretty subdued for basically all year. We haven't seen that much put activity on a relative basis. We've seen a small uptick in that over the last few days, which is good. But we like to watch equity options market. We like to watch action in the inverse ETF market. So how much are investors hedging? Obviously, when they get super scared, then they embrace those inverse ETFs. And when that activity gets up to certain levels, that's a pretty reliable bottoming indicator. So and then there's some other money flow type of smart and dumb money, quote unquote, money flow type of indicators that we watch and that we've quantified that also are helpful. So, it's a combination of those. Nothing ever works perfectly, every time. So, but if you watch a combination of those, you get a pretty good sense of at least short-term investor sentiment.
So, Dana, before we get you out of here, real quick, I just want to know how you are viewing this sell-off in the precious metals. It's been a bad week for gold, silver, the underlying stocks. How have you been trading that sector?
Yeah, it's like a lot of the underlying areas of the market. You look at the S&P, hasn't moved much, but there's a lot of activity, a lot of volatility underneath, and whether it's from the broad, small cap, mid cap averages pulling back to volatility in technology, financials and energy were good buying opportunities, we think, in the last week or so. Same thing with in the precious metals complex. So we did add some exposure back further into that pullback in the beginning of the month in both SLV. We trade ETFs for our clients, so in both SLV and GLD, bought some more exposure then. Gold miners and silver miners bought some more exposure then. Then we rallied up into some technical resistance. We're still overall in a trading range, so we want to be trading the precious metals complex. So took some profits on that a week or two ago, and just yesterday and today buying some of that exposure back in GLD, SLV. You look at the gold miners, GDX, silver miners, SIL, buying a bit of that exposure back after taking some profits a couple weeks ago. So they're still trading markets for us in the longer term, we do have a bullish bias towards those. So we want to be certainly be buying the dips and the technical support, which we think we're at least near there now.
Okay. Dana, always great chatting with you. Thank you for sharing your insights on these markets as we set up to turn the corner into next year. We still have to deal with December, but boy, oh boy, this year has been already very, very good for U.S. equity markets. And on the back end of this, not very good for precious metals investors. Maybe we'll see a different environment 2022, but we'll definitely be chatting with you and keeping up to date. Remember, Dana is running that Black Friday special over at the Lion's Share website. I will post a link to that within the weekend show posting. Dana, again, thank you for your time this weekend.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And we are now wrapping up this weekend's edition with Mark Chandler, managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also writes the Mark to Market blog. Now, the first three segments of this show we recorded on Wednesday, right before U.S. Thanksgiving. And in all fairness, I was thinking that we were going to really record the whole show before Thanksgiving. But boy, oh boy, the volatility that we saw on Friday warrants a whole other direction for this final segment of the show. So, Mark, I'm glad you could join us to talk about what is a pretty down day on Friday. You look across the board, we have U.S. equity markets all down over 2%. We also have the metals down. We have just a lot of red on the screen, and oil really stands out to me because that's down over $10 today. It's a massive drop for oil, and when you consider oil was above $85 at the end of October, we now have a 20% drop in oil. So before we get into oil, Mark, clearly all of this down action on Friday is due to fears about this new COVID variant. Look, clearly investors are scared. This is on everyone's radar. What do you think is most important to understand and to take away from this big drop we are seeing to end the week?
Yeah, what amazing move. I mean, these kind of things happen. I mean, we had one, of course, last year when the COVID first struck. Very sharp, dramatic moves, which means that sometimes it's not just fair value that drives these, right? But it's everybody trying to get out at the same time. And that's the first point I'd make, really, is about market positioning. People with long stocks, they're being forced out of them. Especially, you know, and the same thing that we've seen in the currency markets. Those currencies that were strong, were anticipating stronger growth, tightening moves by central banks, those currencies are moving down, while the currencies that are the funding currencies that are used to buy those assets, safe haven currencies like Swiss franc, the euro, the yen, stronger. So and you're right, it's all about this new variant. We really don't know much about it, except it's already been found in three or four different countries outside of Africa. And the issue is that this is the most mutated out of the different strains, and that it's going to take a couple of weeks. So this level of uncertainty, that's the second point I really make, is we live in a world that's not so absolute, right? It's a probabilistic world. And so the trajectory that we were on before, it seems to me, the market is saying that there's a lower chance, a lower probability that past trajectory is going to continue. With this virus taking us off, and I think that's partly behind the oil. People are worried about the compression of demand. That if we have to go back into a lockdown situation, that's really the other point I'd make, is that COVID was on the rise in Europe. Record number of cases today in Germany, for example, new lockdowns in Austria, that it was rising in the United States before this new variant. And so it's sort of a bit of a pushing on an open door in the sense of that these forces were developing prior to this big news announcement.
Mark, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because in all fairness, oil was already correcting from 85 down into the mid-70s before this announcement came out. So the direction was already to the downside. And some of the market weakness we were already seeing earlier in the week. So this exasperated it. There's no doubt about it on Friday. But how much do you think this will stick, this, I guess, this fear of this new strain versus all the other data that's coming in, whether it's the labor markets, the GDP growth, the inflation? I mean, how much does it matter in the bigger scheme of things? Because some of these trends were already in motion and all this did was accelerate them.
Yeah, I think it accelerated them. I think the question is like, for example, how far does oil have to come down before you think that we're that the bull market is over? You know, we've chopped through some very key levels in the January WTI ahead of the weekend, including through the 200-day moving average. And that 200-day moving average comes in around 69.75. And I think that's really like the issue is that this all of a sudden, like, this, not that the waters were calm, but I think people had a feel for them, or they thought they had a feel for them. And now this thing is sort of dumped on the on our laps. What does this mean for going to the holiday season? What does this mean for tourism? All this kind of like the green shoots of growth, does this just cut them off? And if it does, then we have to begin looking at, you know, the idea of dramatically slower world growth, dramatically change in the monetary policy outlook. You know, earlier this week, New Zealand did what everybody anticipated them to do, raise rates 25 basis points. There was some marginal disappointment. There were some people who thought they could cut 50, actually to raise 50 basis points. They did 25. They said they'd be raising rates much more, like three or four more times next year. And the New Zealand dollar is the weakest of the major currencies this week. And I think it's weak because the market had one priced in, and two, it doesn't think it's going to be able to deliver on those future rate hikes.
Mark, we have to consider how investors are viewing this news on the COVID variant, because quite frankly, the way that, let's say, the S&P is setting up just this week, and a lot of this drop is really just predicated on the action on Friday, it's going to be one of the largest drops weekly for the whole year. We go the whole way back to January to see a drop for a week that we are seeing this week. What do you think about the mentality of investors? Because even as Shad was saying, taking into account all this other data that was driving markets, clearly COVID news can take hold and trump everything.
Yeah, I think that's like the like a wild card in some ways. You know, and it, for a few years ago, it was about what's that unknown thing that could take away, like that could change the dynamics, like a terrorist incident, for example. I think that a lot of people, we've learned over the over for several years, for maybe more than a decade, to buy dips. And I've typically wanted to do that. But this one scares me a bit. I think the uncertainty is going to linger a while. And I can see that other people who might be tempted to pick a bottom are also staying back. Here we are late in the North American session, and the S&Ps haven't even been able to bounce. And so I think that people like me, that mentality, I say, yes, we want to buy on the dip. And that's why we sold into the rally. And we've got the cash. We've got the cash on the sidelines. We're ready to buy. But we want to see this thing stabilize and see some more sign of what the impact of this new virus really means.
Well, Mark, it hasn't just been the general markets, and it hasn't just been the commodities that have been all over the place this week and especially today. The currency markets have been a little bit crazy. We were talking off mic before we recorded just how wrong-footed most of the currency traders have been. They were short things that went long and long things that went short. So we're seeing that, you know, the U.S. dollar strength has continued against most currencies, but there's also some of these other major currencies that you mentioned briefly in one of your opening statements, that like the yen, that has been outperforming the euro, but it's been underperforming the dollar. And then there's some of the commodity currencies like the Canadian dollar, like the Aussie, like the Kiwi, that are also, you know, strong. So what do you make of the kind of the mess that the currency markets are in right now?
Yeah, so sometimes I think of the dollar as being like, I mean, it's the primary currency in the world. All these commodities are measured in it. Countries measure their currency's value against it. Reserves are kept in dollars. So sometimes the dollar is the actor. But sometimes the dollar, I find, is at like the middle of a seesaw. And that's where I think it is now. And on one hand, like you say, you've got the Aussie, Canada, Kiwi, Scandinavian currencies that they do well typically in times of strong growth, when they have strong risk appetites. And then the other side of the seesaw are the currencies that typically have low interest rates used for funding And some people anticipate that funding, and they talk about it as a safe haven. And so I think that's really where we are now, is where those safe haven currencies used as funding currencies are being bought up. You know, the dollar yen is very, it, to me, is like it's not quite a car accident, but it's watching closely, like, and trying to get that market sentiment and psychology. Here's what happened. We broke out of a range back in the fall, and it looked like we were moved into a new trading range, roughly 113, roughly 115. A couple weeks ago, we dipped below the lower end of the range, fell to about 112.80 or so, popped right back into the range. Then earlier this week, we're testing the top end of the range. We're fraying it. We got to 115.50. That's where we were Wednesday. Today, we got back down to 113. And I think that it's, I think that one of the things that attracts people to the foreign exchange market is its volatility. And it's the ability to leverage. And I think as traders, we have to decide whether we're in a trading range or whether we're in a trending market. And I think, you know, you people look for that breakout, and it punishes you if you're wrong.
So, Mark, taking into account now this renewed fear coming back into the markets, and again, based solely on these new COVID variants or this new COVID variant, what are you doing with your portfolio? Are you standing pat, waiting to see how this all plays out? Because in all fairness, if we get some news from some of the drug companies that this variant is treatable through whatever, the vaccines or new pills, then maybe this is just a very short-term drop, but maybe this is start of something bigger. How are you positioning your portfolio? Are you being active, or are you being simply standing on the sidelines, seeing how it all plays out?
Yes, I'm standing on the sidelines here. I mean, we had talked back in the middle of September. Remember when the Evergrande, that Chinese developer, was crashing, and everybody was warning that it was the biggest thing since Lehman, or the Chinese version of Lehman? I bought on that dip, but I've learned the hard way that buying on dip strategies only works if you can sell rallies. And so I've struggled with that myself, and I ended up selling the rally a couple weeks ago, earlier in November. I bought the Qs, the NASDAQ 100, and I am tempted to buy, but I don't like the price action ahead of the weekend. And the vaccine, or I shouldn't say the vaccine, but the new virus, it's still not, I don't have enough information. Is it like you say, there's so many unknowns. And so until some clearer sign, it might take a while for either a clearer sign from the science or a clearer sign from the price action that's exhausted. So I'm sort of in a wait-and-see mode.
Well, Mark, I'm not even sure if economic data is going to matter next week, but there are a couple important economic reports coming out next week and data points. Why don't you walk us through some of the ones that you think are most important for investors to keep their eyes on?
Sure. Yeah, so next week, two big economic reports will stand out. One is the U.S. jobs data. And I agree with you. It's this new variant and what this means for policy going forward. I mean, we're already seeing many countries put on travel restrictions. But the jobs data is important because of where we are in the big picture of things. And it looks like the U.S. probably grew another 500,000 jobs or so this month, November. It should be a solid jobs report. It's around the average that we've had this year. 500,000 a month, still a healthy clip. And I think that we might see it even pick up again faster in the early part of next year. And the other big economic piece of data we get comes from the Europeans, and this is on inflation. They released the preliminary estimate of November CPI. And by all accounts, it's going to accelerate. We know, so how to think about inflation, I think, in Europe is two big drivers, energy and the exchange rate. And so we know so leaving aside this last couple of days of price action with oil, you got to think about like the monthly average. We know that natural gas skyrocketed. We know the euro is weaker. And those two things probably push up inflation, and you've got the base effect on top of that. And so we should expect a pickup in the an acceleration of the European CPI well above 4%. And so I think to your point, does this matter? Well, I think that I think that if it wasn't for this new variant, we would see the hawks being able to push back against the doves at the ECB in the December meeting. And the key there, of course, is that the hawks are arguing that they're out of the emergency. And so they need to be adjusting monetary policy because inflation is becoming unanchored, twice the target, and rising. But with this new variant, I think that it's hard to say they were out of that emergency yet. So those are the two big releases, U.S. jobs data and the European CPI. We do get a couple of meetings that are interesting. Both Powell and Yellen testified before Congress. We get the OPEC meeting as well. The OPEC Plus, they're going to decide how to respond to this to the consumers releasing whatever it is, 60 to 70 million barrels of oil. OPEC, you know, starting in the beginning of every month, and they want to put back, they plan on putting back 400,000 barrels a day to replace what was taken out. Remember last year when the big drop in oil prices? And it's a question really now of what OPEC, how OPEC responds. Does it recognize that this drop price in oil doesn't really have to do anything? Or are they going to cut back on the amount of oil they're going to release to the market instead of trying to punish the consumers for releasing their strategic reserves?
All right, Mark, we're wrapping it up here. This wraps up the weekend edition of the KE Report. And boy, oh boy, what a, I think, surprise Friday really was, and has, I'm sure, a lot of traders questioning the direction heading into the end of the year of markets. And really, again, a lot predicated just on the back of updated COVID news. We've all been watching COVID, feels like forever. And clearly COVID still can have some pretty quick and fast effects on markets. Mark, thank you very much for joining us this weekend. Everybody, thank you for tuning in. Again, please go back through our website throughout this week. That is kereport.com. Listen to all the daily editorials and listen to all the company updates we recorded and released for all of you. As always, you can always keep in touch with Shad and I through email at flex@kereport.com or shad@kereport.com. We love hearing from each and every one of you. Everybody, have a great rest of your weekend.